It's the weekend, and you have financial questions that need answering. That can only mean one thing. It's time for Jill on Money, the show that takes the mystery out of your finances. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
Welcome to Jill on Money. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. And we are delighted to welcome you this weekend. It is a big weekend here at the program because it's Mark's birthday. Woo! Greatest producer in the world. It's his birthday. Yay! Okay, that's enough of that. It's not a big birthday though, right, Mark? It's a sort of a medium nothing birthday, right? Well, yes, you are getting older, but it'll take a really long time for you to catch up to me. That's all I can say. You know, it's been such a fun week because there's been no mention of Greece falling off the face of the earth. So thank goodness. I mean, it's still continuing. The Greek drama will never end, frankly. But what's great about this is that I can, like, free my brain to think about lots of other things going on in the world. You know, like, the Federal Reserve. It's very exciting to think about the Federal Reserve for me. You know, I always laugh when I see Janet Yellen or Ben Bernanke or even Alan Greenspan testify before Congress because those lawmakers, they really are such dope sometimes. They ask, like, the dumbest questions, honestly. And I just love to see the amount of patience that has to be created for the Fed chair to deal with how dopey they are sometimes. But this is not a political show. It's a financial show. So let's start with an exciting first for Jill on Money. It is our first international caller. So we've got Jeannie on the line from Frankfurt, Germany. Hi, Jeannie. Welcome to Jill on Money. This is exciting for us. How are you?
I'm fine. It's exciting for me, too.
Fantastic. What's going on? First of all, you don't sound German.
No, I'm an American working overseas for the Department of Defense.
Oh, interesting. So what's going on? How can I help you?
Well, I think I want to retire next year and move to Paris for a couple of years before I go back to the States and all my responsibilities. And I was hoping you could help me look through my financial situation.
That is so exciting. Now, wait a second. Just do you speak every language, or you speak German and you speak French, or are you just an Americano stumbling through Europe?
Well, I speak German, I speak both languages.
Wow, that's awesome. That's so great. So, tell us a little bit about yourself. You sound so young. How old are you?
I'm 59.
Oh my gosh! And this is the time to do it, I guess. Are you single or are you coupled?
Well, I'm divorced, and I have one child, but she's out on her own now.
So you are free as a bird, baby.
I am.
Oh my God! So next year, if you were to retire, you'd be 60 years old. Tell me about the income that you would have.
Well, I would have about $3,000 with my retirement. I'm eligible for federal retirement, so TSP, mm-hmm. Defined benefit, and mm-hmm. Then Social Security when I'm old enough. Plus, I have a rental house that I net about $700 a month. So I think until I'm old enough to get Social Security, and I'm going to wait that long also to withdraw my TSP. But until that point, I'll have about $3,000 a month, which is, I think, about what I need.
Okay. I think about living in Paris, and I think, is $3,000 a month enough? But you've done your checking on this. Is it enough?
Yeah, I think so. It's for a very small apartment, I think it's going to, in a nice part of town, I think it's going to run me about 1,200 euros. So, $1,400, mm-hmm. Which is about what I'll clear from the retirement money that I get.
Okay. All right. Well, that's actually pretty good. I'm surprised, actually, that I'm pleasantly surprised for you that it's that cheap. So you've got this income that can float you for a couple of years. And then what about your savings? Tell me a little bit about the savings.
You mean like TSP and that?
Yes,
kind of thing?
Exactly.
Okay, so my TSP, I have about $530,000 I have a Roth IRA, which is about $105,000, mm-hmm. a non-qualified annuity, which is about $5,000, a mutual fund, $13,000, and then I have a good bit of money in checking and savings, more than I should have cash.
How much, just so we have an idea about that?
Okay. I have $98,000 in my U.S. savings account. Mm-hmm. I have $17,000 in my checking. And then I have €98,000 in a German bank account.
Wait, so you've got, all right, so let's just, so you've got €100,000, which is whatever, $110,000. And so that you could easily supplement whatever is going on in terms of Paris, right?
Yeah, that's, the reason I've kept it in euros because I was hoping that I'd be able to retire and spend a few years in Paris. So that's why I've kept that money in euros.
Okay, great. That's perfect. And, so let's talk about the next couple of years. So let's pretend, at least for the time being, I know you know, we don't really know your exact expenses, you know, and obviously I think you're going to spend more than $3,000 a month, but that you have this €100,000 stash makes me feel a lot better. So if you look at the savings part, you've done a fabulous job. I mean, really, it seems to me that you're in very good shape. What do we think, more like 3 years or 2 years? What's your hope? Let's try to give you your best case scenario. Like, what would you like, 3 years or 5 years? What do you really want to do, and like how much time?
Oh, well, really 5 years, but I was thinking probably I should do a year and evaluate at the end of each year.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
Just based on what's going.
But you know what? I think that let's think of it as like, I'm going to think of it as like a 2 to 3 year experiment, because then I could say to you is, let's presume that over the course of the next 2 to 3 years, if you live in Paris, that let's just pretend that the €100,000 goes away. You're going to spend it. Are you okay with that? I mean, you've done a great job of saving, but are you okay spending down that euro account?
Yeah, I'm okay spending that down. I don't want to take any of my TSP out till I'm 65 or 66.
Well, so that's what I'm thinking exactly. That's exactly where I'm going with this. So I'm saying that if you were at age 63, okay, let's say that you come back to the States at age 63 and you're done with, the euros are gone. Just pretend, okay? But you still have $110,000, $20,000, or let's say $115,000 in cash in the U.S., so the question is, this is what I'm going to do. We're going to keep talking. This is like the most fun question ever, because it's like fantasy land question and she's really doing it. So what we need to figure out from Jeannie is, once she's done with 3 years in living in Paris, a dream, frankly, when she returns, what's going to happen for ages 64 to 65? Will she be able to wait to tap into all of that retirement savings, or will there have to be some adjustment? So when we come back, we've now got the part down around Paris, and then it's back to the United States for Jeannie. So you are listening to Jill on Money, where we specialize in making your dreams reality. All right, maybe not. But anyway, this is a great question. 855-411-JILL is our phone number. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
It doesn't matter if you're 25 or 65, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Back to Jill on Money.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. The phone number here is 855-411-JILL. You can send us an email, the email address, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We got a great question from Jeannie. She's living in Frankfurt, Germany. She's still on the line. She's calling us from Frankfurt, Germany. That's so awesome. I think it's on our nickel. We called her because, you know, that's too much to ask you. But now, Jeannie, you've got perhaps what I would call just a dream scenario here. Jeannie works for the Department of Defense, and she's living in Germany now. Next year, at age 60, she's thinking about retiring, but not just regular old retirement like you and me. She's going to move to Paris for a few years. How great is that? And wants to know whether she can actually financially swing this dream. So before we went to the break, Jeannie, we kind of figured out that you're going to have about $3,000 a month in income for the next few years, and that you have this 100,000 euro account, which is about $110,000. So I'm presuming that if you spend 3 years in Paris, you know, you'd probably plow through most of that money, because maybe you'll do other traveling. And so then if you came back to the States at age 64 or 65, tell me what happens when you come back. Where will you be living? Do you have a place to stay? Do you need to buy something? Are you going to be renting? What's the situation?
Well, when I come back, I have a house that's paid off, and so I'd move into that house at least until I turn 65 or 66 and start collecting Social Security. But my big problem is until age 62, I get what's considered a Social Security supplement. It's kind of an incentive to retire early, and the government will replace part of what you would get in Social Security until age 62.
Right.
Well, once I turn 62, I'll no longer get that.
How much
and
is that?
So now pardon me?
How much is that?
It'll be about $800.
Okay. So you just need an extra $800 a month after from 62, 3, 4, 5, right?
Right.
Okay. That's okay. You got money. That's not a problem. I mean, you do have this $115,000 in cash, in U.S. dollars, right?
Yes.
So that's not a problem. I don't see that to be a problem at all. So, I mean, again, let's just go through this. We spend down the euro account. If you have to pull an extra $10,000 out of your cash, by the time you get home for, let's do some of this math here, okay? Because if you have 115 now and you got to spend an extra $800 a month for two of the years before you can collect, you know, we'll spend some of that money down. That's not a big deal. So I still think you get back to the States at age 64, and you know, instead of having 115,000 in cash, you might have 95 in cash or something, right? And then at that point, what do you think the expenses will be? I mean, like you said, you're not going to have to pay rent anymore. Your house is paid off. You'll have regular living expenses, but maybe that $3,000 a month will actually cover your needs. I don't know. What do you think?
You know, I've lived outside of the States for so long, I'm not even aware of, like, what utility bills cost or anything like that anymore.
Right.
So I'm not sure.
Well, let's say this. I'm going to say that you probably – I'm going to presume that even if you can't use $3,000 a month, and you need more. I'm betting that you're not going to need more than another $2,000 a month. Okay. So that's $24,000. Let's round it up. Let's say that you're going to, of the cash on hand when you come back to the States, until you get to Social Security retirement age, which did you say is 65 or 66 for you?
I'm at 66 and 4 months.
Okay. So let's presume that for those years, you're going to use the cash that's sitting in your U.S. cash account, right? And you're going
right.
to spend some of that cash down so that when you turn 66 and you're ready to collect Social Security, you're not going to have $115,000. You're going to probably have more like 30, let's say worst case, 30 to 35,000. That's going to be your cash cushion. But you will not have touched your $650,000 in TSP, Roth, not your annuity or your mutual fund. And then at that point, so now we're just bridging the gap, right? We're just sort of saying you have done something amazing, which is maybe realizing it, not realizing it. But what you have done is you've socked away cash to actually give you the bridge between the times when you're going to get different streams of income. And I think that's brilliant. I don't know if you, did you mean to do it? Because it's really fabulous.
No, I didn't know what to do with the cash, so I just sat on it.
Whether designed or accident, it's perfect. Because now what happens, now you're at 66 and change, you claim your Social Security, right? And at that point, you're going to have, what did you say your Social Security benefit would be?
I'm at 66, It'll be about $2,200 a month.
And that, in addition to your pension, will give you...
Plus, I'll also get a Florida retirement because I'm invested in the Florida retirement system.
Oh, great. So, and
not
then,
a lot of, not a lot of money. But
we have the $1,500, right? We have the $1,500 from your regular government pension, $350 and $2,200. That's a nice chunk of income to have as a guarantee. It really is. That's your $3,000 a month, right? And now you're 66 years old. You've got, and I'm, let's pretend you have zero growth in the next few years. You're going to have some growth, but you've got $650,000. Okay. It's going to be more than that. But even if I give you a 3% withdrawal rate, you take 3% of that $650,000 out every year, that's giving you another $1,600 a month. You are in great shape. I think you can do this. Number one, you have set aside the cash you need to actually execute this dream plan. So you've got your – and all of this, I'm giving you much more conservative assumptions than I think are actually going to occur. But let's be conservative, right? You pretend to yourself that you have to give yourself permission to do this, Janie, because you know what? There's no reason why you worked so hard and saved all this money to start to be frugal while you're in Paris. You gotta let yourself like have the dream. And frankly, as far as I'm concerned, you can stay there as long. If you called me in 3 years and said, you know that 100,000 euros I had, I still have 50,000 euros left, then you could stay longer. I mean, you might miss us. Don't you think you'd miss the United States? You might be jonesing for like some great ribs. You're never going to get great ribs in Paris. Just forget it. Okay. But that's about it.
I think you're right.
So I think this is great. So you've created the bucket system, which is you've got this cash to supplement for the next few years that you're living in Paris. You come home, you're no longer paying rent. And then at that point, and that's the point probably where, you know, you're losing that after 62. So 62, so the four or five years between 62 and 66 and change, you're going to use the cash in your U.S. dollar denominated account to float your needs. And then you're going to claim your Social Security at 66 and 4 months or 6 months. And you are going to have a nice $3,000 a month of income. Then you will be able to tap all that $650,000 and you'll be able to do that efficiently. And I think you are in fantastic shape. I am buying into the dream. It's Jeannie's dream. I'm buying. I'm in. I'm a buyer. Are you feeling good about it?
I'm really excited to hear. I expected you really to say, are you kidding me? I'm so excited that you...
No way! Are you kidding me? Mark and I are like, how do we get on? Mark's going to go to Italy. That's what his path is. Go forth. Find yourself an apartment. Just remember, if you spent a boatload of money and if all of a sudden your euro account is drained after 2 years, then you come home. But as far as I'm concerned, as long as that account has money and you can supplement your income, you are sitting pretty, lady. Au revoir. See you soon. Adios. A wiedersehen. Goodbye. That's amazing. Thank you so much, Jeannie, for calling and let us in on your dream. It's fantastic. So thank you. Thank you. Mark, where do you want to go? Italy? Paris? He's going both. We're going to try to make this happen. Hey, you want to live your dream? Let's see if we can make it happen for you. 855-411-JILL. That's our phone number. And you can also email us, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
It doesn't matter if you're 25 or 65, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Back to Jill on Money.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. 855-411-JILL. Get you on the air live. You can always send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Okay, here's Jeff in New Jersey, who's got a housing question. This is a real housing kind of show. Our house has been on the market for 5 months. We initially had it on for $579,000, We lowered the price to $499. We have had one offer for cash, $368. He's calling baloney. He didn't say baloney, but he said something else. Here's the issue. The mortgage resets on September 1st. And, there's an ex-wife. So they're getting divorced, they're divorced and they own the house together. Ex-wife and I cannot afford the increase of the mortgage reset. That's going to happen to a lot of people, that these mortgages that were adjustable rates that were, you know, really low for a few years, they are going to start to reset. My ex-wife and I are pondering whether or not we should make these mortgage payments. In the best case, already it's going to be a short sale whenever it sells. What's our degree of damage for that? Should we just not pay? Is that as bad as a short sale? And here are the numbers. So let's get these numbers down for a second. So he's got the house on for $499. He doesn't have a nibble. But he's got a $449,000 mortgage, and then he's got a home equity loan of $44,000. So at $499, he basically breaks even. And he said, should we try to convert this? Is it better for us to walk away? My ex-wife is really freaking out. So am I. Oh, this is a terrible story. All right. So I think first of all, let's talk about the issue of a short sale and what it does to your credit. It's not good. Okay. Frankly, your credit is going to be kind of messed up for a while. Even if it's a short sale and you keep paying, it's going to be messed up. And if you stop paying your mortgage payment, it's also going to be messed up. So, what I think you ought to do, and not knowing about other parts of your life, it may be worth your while to sit down with an attorney. And I'm not saying you're going to declare bankruptcy, but you should talk to a bankruptcy attorney about which is the preferable way to go. Because I'm sort of thinking, and I'm not a lawyer, so I really want you to talk to a lawyer about this, that if you stop paying the mortgage, all right, and you sell the house eventually, and I honestly would just fire sell the house and just get rid of it, you're going to have to go to the bank anyway and negotiate something, right? Because you're not going to get all your money back. You're going to owe the bank more than you're going to get in proceeds. So since you're already going to have to start wheeling and dealing with the bank, one way to get the bank's attention is to say, we're not going to be paying the mortgage. And then at least you can save a few shekels. What I don't want you to do is I don't want you to start pulling money out of your retirement account to make the payments on the loan. You are going to likely have to negotiate with the lenders. And I don't know if the home equity is the same lender as the primary mortgage, but they're going to be on notice that, hey, you're not getting your money back, bank. I'm sort of wondering, like, did you misprice it? But that's just a totally separate issue. Maybe it's a weird house or something. So I think that what you have to know is that your credit's going to be trashed. Hopefully you both have a place to go. I'm a little concerned. I don't know whether you live in the house or your ex-wife lives in the house, but both of you, if you're on the loan and you have a short sale or you stop paying the mortgage, you're going to trash your credit. That could be a problem if you don't have a place to live yet. So the answer to the question is, if you both have a next place to move into, then you can probably stop paying the mortgage. But if either one of you is living in that house and hasn't secured a new home yet, what is very vital here is you keep making your payments, because even if you're going to rent next, they're going to run a credit check. And a lot of landlords don't want people who have had late payments on their mortgage. So I think the key to this is, where are you going next? Is that set? And if it's not, then you're going to have to keep paying the mortgage. If it isn't set yet, then get it set now. And then perhaps, like, you get your rent, you got your apartment, or you got your house, or whatever, you're moving in with your mother or your brother or whoever. And then you can start talking to a lawyer and determine whether or not it makes sense to stop paying the mortgage. Obviously, you're going to have to stop paying the mortgage anyway on September 1st, which, you know, is around the corner. And that's going to start to hurt your credit. So we need you guys to have your next housing decision made and secured so that you don't find yourself scrambling. Otherwise, you're really going to be in a bit of hot water. This is such a terrible situation, and I feel bad for both sides. And I know there's going to be some folks who call us and say, you know, these people, they're welching on their loans. But, you know, Pete, things happen. I don't want to get all judgmental around this issue because, frankly, we don't know what led to all of this. And there's plenty of people who got caught up in the housing bubble and the bursting of the bubble. And when there's a divorce or an illness, a medical situation in the middle of it all, it can really start to pile up. And I can just kind of foresee a circumstance how that occurred for this couple. I wish you the best of luck. But again, once you are in a short sale, once you start missing mortgage payments, your credit score is going to suffer. And as a result, it could be hard for you to actually secure your next housing decision. Okay? Oh, that's a bad one. Rots. All right. You're listening to Jill on Money. We go from dreams realized to dreams dashed. 855-411-JILL or send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Annuities, IRAs, 401ks, she covers it all. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. It's 855-411-JILL or send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. There's a great article last week about how the bidding wars are heating up around the country. Now, it's not everywhere, but as I promised to you way back when we did our real estate show, that the market is going to get better, and it does not mean that every single house in every single market there's going to be a bidding war. It's just that generally we are seeing a improvement in the housing market. And thank you very much. We'll take it. Right? Why are we hoping? Oh, no, it's not that. Well, you know, it's good. Improvement is good. Okay? I just have some stats to throw at you before you kind of get too excited. First of all, the homeownership rate is basically still the lowest since 1989. 1989, in case you were wondering, that's a long time ago. But, you know, here's the problem. A lot of people who really would like to move still are underwater, meaning they owe more on their mortgage than their home is worth. Lots can't qualify for a new mortgage. And, you know, there's just not a lot of, this the supply of houses is really low, okay? Usually what we rely on is household formation. That means that people kind of get in, like they leave their parents, they go out, they get a job, they buy a house. But most of the households that were formed, 1.5 million in the first quarter, they were all formed by renters. Now, renters could be under pressure with student loans. It could be a lot of things. But, you know, the real issue here is that there's not a huge supply. That's creating a big jump in prices, but it's also creating an increase in rents. So it's not like you're so much better off renting versus buying. We don't know for your case. And so if you're thinking about renting versus buying, of course, give us a holler. Love to hear from you and talk about what makes sense for you. Now, Alex wrote in that he just turned his residence into a rental and then he bought another home. He says, I owe $194,000 at 3.75%. That's a pretty good rate. We'll take that. $1,400 a month. He says, the market is strong to sell, and I could net $95,000. Should I keep my rental as future retirement or sell and pay off most of my debt? No capital gains right now. He says he's 42. It's my only investment for retirement that I own. By the way, monthly rent could be $1,600 a month. I have 27 years to go on the mortgage. I have so many more questions for you, Alex, so I'm going to kind of wing it and try to give you some generalities here. Look, a rental property can be a terrific income generator in the future, but it can also be a pain in the neck. So if you're fine managing the process and being the property manager or the landlord, it may be interesting for you to keep this thing rocking and rolling. I'm wondering why you're so interested in just paying off the debt. Because if you haven't, sounds like you haven't saved a ton of money yet for retirement. And so I'm wondering, why not take the cash flow from the rental property and start pouring it into retirement savings? Now, you don't write about how much money you make and what else is going on in your life, but I have to say that right now, if you're 42 years old and this rental property is the only investment you have for retirement, I'd really like you to actually consider putting money away into a retirement plan. Maybe you have one and you just left that off. I guess that I'm not quick to sell it and pay off your debt. And I'm not even so quick to sell it right this second because it is generating this, this nice income. But what I'm suggesting is that you take the income from the rent and you can use that for your living expenses and then start to really put a lot of money away into retirement. I think that, like I said, rental real estate is fantastic in terms of, being able to be a generator of income. That said, it can't be your only investment. That I'm not comfortable with. I'm really not. And, when you think about where you stand in your retirement at age 42, I know it's hard to project, how you're going to feel about managing this property when you're 20 years from now, but what can you do with the cash flow today in that property to make it better for you and to make it work for you? How can you capture that cash flow? In some cases, it might be that extra cash from the rental property might mean that you could start maxing out your retirement plan through work. And that's kind of a neat thing because now it's reducing your taxable income. So send us a follow-up. I really would be interested to find out how you feel about the idea of hanging on to both of them, but really starting to crank up your saving and investing as a result of having this extra rental income. And I presume that, you have enough income to do this because you were able to keep the house as a rental and buy a new house. So, by the way, rents are rising pretty dramatically across the country, especially on the coasts. So, it's not going to be a great time to be a renter in the next 20 years. It's good. It's flexibility. I love it. But you still have to be a little bit careful about planning in the future on what that rent is going to be. All right. It's Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL, 855-411-JILL, or send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, give us a call. 855-411-JILL or send an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. And stay tuned because next hour we're going to have a guest, Don Cloud. I love that name. Rising High with Don Cloud, something like that. You like that as the name of the show? Flying High with Don Cloud, should that be our title of the show? That's a pretty good title. Anyway, he is a financial advisor, And he's going to come and talk to us about some planning techniques if you have an unexpected early retirement and some other ideas that he has about how you should be managing your money in this environment. So stay tuned. Don Cloud is coming up in the next hour. Okay, so I got a great question from somebody about a mortgage. This is a 30-year versus 15-year question, okay? So Sam writes, I watched my parents really struggle during the housing crisis, and I really, really don't want to have a mortgage when I'm in my 50s or 60s. Therefore, I'm about to buy a new apartment in New York City and plan to pay cash for as much as possible. But by paying cash and using all of my extra cash flow for a 15-year mortgage, I'm not going to have a lot of money left over to save for retirement. What do you think? It scares me to have a mortgage. So this is a tough one because I think when you watch people suffer, that's called, and then you bring that experience into your life today, that's called recency bias. It means whatever just happened forms how you feel today. And so, Sam, what I would say is this. You didn't mention how young you are, but it sounds like you're young. So I'm going to say that if you're in your 30s and you're buying a place, you don't have to put like the minimum down. You don't have to put 10% down, but put 20 down, give yourself some cash flow, get a 30-year mortgage, and think to yourself, you can always pay it off later, but really don't stop contributing to your retirement plan. Please don't. You want to do a little bit of both. All right? You're listening to Jill on Money. And if you've got a financial question, give us a call. The phone number here, 855-411-JILL, or send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
It's the weekend, which means it's time for Jill on Money, the show that makes money fun and just happens to answer all your financial questions. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
Welcome back. It's hour number two of Jill on Money, and we are delighted to have a special guest. His name is Don Cloud, and with a name like that, it's going to be a soaring few segments. All right, I couldn't help it. It's terrible. Okay, he began his career in financial services in the 1990s. His mission, he wants to educate and inspire individuals to play an active role in their personal finances. Don, welcome to Jill on Money. How are you?
Good. Yes, I'm doing well. Thank you.
Wait a second. That's some accent. I'm not sure I knew you had an accent like that. Where are you from?
I'm from Alabama. Yeah, unfortunately.
What?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Have an interpreter.
I love it. It's fantastic. It's terrific. So you actually got into this business because of a very personal reason. So can you share that with us?
Yes. You know, as I grew up and came along, I understand how important money was. And the way I got into this industry was it turned out that my future wife's father was in this industry. So at a pretty young age, I understood how important it was to make sure that you had everything correct because, you know, we can absorb little mistakes as we go along, but big mistakes can absorb us. So
that's for sure. And was there something about your own family going through a stressful time about were your parents' retirement? What happened with that?
Oh, yeah. Actually, yes. Now I know what you're referring to. Yeah, the thing that happened is my dad passed about 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's kind of like the carpenter who doesn't have his own house. Mm-hmm. Although my parents did everything and knew everything and followed a lot of my advice, there was one small account, one small thing that he had missed. He did not set up TODs on one of the accounts.
Mm-hmm.
As such,
transfer on death for everybody who's thinking about what the heck is he talking about.
And even though, you know, this is what I do for a living, it really hit home because, you know, this is something that's so easy to avoid. And we spent close to 6 months, moving that asset over into my mother's name. So
funny you should say that, because my dad died almost 2 years ago, and I was a financial advisor for 14 years, and I'd always said to him, he would say to me, I have the houses in mommy's name, right? And I said, okay, but like, you did that for reasons because you were a small business owner and you wanted it in her name. And I said, but it should be jointly held, because one of you could die and then we're only going to get a $250,000 estate exclusion instead of $500,000. And you know what he said to me? He goes, yeah, but I'll be selling the house before that, so I don't want to go through the rigmarole. Guess what? Death beat him out of that mission. And so now my mom's selling her house and she can only exclude $250,000 of capital gains, and she could have had $500,000. Because why? Because it was just like, and shame on me, I didn't follow up enough, I didn't nudge him enough. But you never know, right?
Exactly. We can do everything. We can tell people, but ultimately they have to take, control of it themselves.
That's it. Absolutely. Yeah. So, Don, tell us a little bit about your practice. You deal with normal people, super rich people. What's going on in your life?
Well, I like to think that my practice revolves around, those people that have worked, they've saved, and, they've got anywhere from, $200,000 to $300,000 up to $2 or $3 million. So
nice.
It's not the ultra wealthy, and it's not on the super low side either.
Yeah, so but isn't $2 or $3 million is better than $200,000 or $300,000?
Yes,
let's be honest.
Yes. So we cover a wide range, but it's really about the guys that want to make sure that they go into retirement with peace of mind, knowing that hey, I've got this.
Right.
So.
And do you feel like, you say that you're very into education? I think there's been a lot of advisors get kind of. I don't know. How can I say this? I think they give short shrift to education, because I think that they're like, just do what I say. I don't want to deal with this right now. Right. I'm the expert. Let me be the expert.
Right.
And how do you educate your clients? How do you bridge the gap? Because sometimes they're just not going to get some of the stuff that you're talking about.
Well, number one is what we try to do is we want to correlate it to what they've done their whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can correlate it in terms that we're all used to, then a lot of times we grasp it. The way I kind of tell my clients is, it's my job to bring ideas and concepts to you, and it's your job to make the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Don't just listen to what I say. Let me show you. Let me, verify and validate what I'm saying so that you can make the decision.
Yeah. And do you feel like sometimes that you have to kind of let it go, meaning – sometimes they're not going to do what you tell them to do, right?
Yep.
And how is that? Is that hard for you? Come on, tell the truth.
It's difficult when I know that they're making a mistake. And if I tell, but once I tell them the reason why I think they're making a mistake by not implementing a strategy or a plan that I'm particularly telling them that they should, as long as they understand the consequences of that decision, then I'm okay.
All right.
I've been told.
Okay. And you know what? I tell you, someone gave me great advice when I was a very young advisor. I was freaking out about, you'll appreciate this. I had told this youngish couple, I don't know, like they're 30 years old, they're married, they had 3 kids. And I said, listen, you need life insurance. Just let's get a cheap term policy. And they really pushed back. And they're like, well, what? The guy's like, well, okay, I make all the money. She's at home with the kids. Why do I need to get her life insurance? I'm just throwing money away. And I say, well, things, it's a weird life. You can't anticipate everything I think it was literally $500 a year for a term life insurance policy for the wife. I said, but if she dropped dead, God forbid, you going to work as hard as you're working now? Might she need some extra help? Wouldn't a little cash cushion be good? Anyway, I went crazy with them. I went so crazy, I nudged them they almost left me as clients because I nudged them so much. And I'm telling my friend this story, who's a doctor, and she goes, Jill, you know how many times I tell people to don't drink, don't smoke, eat better, and she goes, sometimes they're just going to do what they're going to do, and they just have to understand the risk. So I totally understand where you're coming from. It's hard to let it go, though, isn't it?
It is. It is very difficult. But once again, once I've explained, what it is, if they're okay with the consequences of that decision, then I have to walk. I have to be okay with it too.
I know, and that's a tough one. I think that's a very tough one for advisors. I really do. All right, now we're coming up to a break. When we come back, you're very interested in this idea of what happens if you have an unexpected early retirement. And it's so funny because, you know, we talk all the time about how people are going to be working more in their 60s and 70s and we live longer. So when we come back from our break, we're going to talk to Don Cloud, investment advisor, and fabulous accent. We're going to talk to him about what to do if you have an unexpected early retirement and how you may be able to cope with this unfortunate and unforeseen circumstance. So we're going to talk to Don about that. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL, and you can give us a holler at askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Young, old, it doesn't matter. She's here to help you. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
Come fly with me.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. The phone number here is 855-411-JILL, or send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We are continuing with our conversation with Don Cloud. He's the president of founder of Cloud Financial, financial industry veteran since the 90s. And so before I went to the break, I teased this concept about what happens if you face an unexpected early retirement. Don, I bet when you got in the business like me in the 90s, you know, people who were retiring early were living large. They were like, woohoo, I can live, market's up, everything's great. And in this last cycle, in this last huge Great Recession, a lot of people had to face the fact that they lost their jobs at the wrong time. So what do you do if you lose your job and you really want to work till you're 65 or 66, but you lose your job and you're 59, 60? What do you do?
Well, first off, Jill, number one is you have to look at where you are. Stay calm and get an assessment of where you are. And then, you know, take a long, hard look at your expenses and your income. And then from there, in my opinion, it's about, okay, number one, how do I correctly utilize Social Security?
Mm-hmm.
How do I get the most income
mm-hmm.
from what I've already done thus far in my life? And then number three, okay, what can I do outside of the box that may potentially protect me so that I've got a lifetime that I'm going to be okay?
Right. Talk to me. I think a lot of people are sort of nibbling at this idea of a reverse mortgage because now people have more, like the housing market's coming back, right? There's more equity in people's homes. What is your opinion on using a reverse mortgage? Maybe not obviously when you're 62, but as you get older, like let's say that you've got a bunch of money in your IRA, your 401k, you can kind of bridge the gap, but maybe you're worried about the second half of your retirement. Like, you know, had you worked for a bunch more years, you would have been fine. What do you think about tapping that home equity through a reverse mortgage?
Well, that was one of those things that I was talking about being outside the box. This is not what normal people really think about, but you're right, it's becoming more mainstream. The way that I look at reverse mortgages, Jill, is that it's a financial tool.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
And how do you, and like with any financial tool, how do you use it correctly? So, case in point, I had a couple come to me a few years ago, and we ran the numbers. They were going to run dry.
Mm.
They were
That's
apt.
So scary.
It was going to happen.
So scary.
And it was
scary.
Because of a retirement in the late 90s, mm-hmm. and they thought they were going to make 8 to 10% a year, mm-hmm. every year going forward. So it's sad to see that, but when they came to me, I said, hey, you know, we've got to, number one, look at where you are.
Right.
And what we found was that if we could just, and they were still paying on their house, but they were almost had it paid off, you know, but it was going to be 6 or 8 years or 10 before, and they were going to exhaust their funds. I said, you know what? What if we were able to take this off of you?
Right.
So just simply by having that reverse mortgage in place, that cut their expenses dramatically.
Right.
Guess what? Now they're back to where they're comfortable. They've got access. Or they come in. They're clients of mine now. They smile. They're happy. And they understand. You know, they got it.
How? What's your view? You know, I know there's a lot of people in the financial industry, in the financial services industry, that have different viewpoints about when to spend certain assets and how, you know, I mean, things are shifting, right? And that, you know, obviously we have tax implications, but what's your view on this concept of a withdrawal rate? Like, if someone has $1 million, is it okay for them to take the same amount out every year, a straight line, or should they be altering what they take out during retirement based on how well the market's doing? What's your opinion on that?
Personally, it is very difficult to do tax planning.
Mm-hmm.
When your income is fluctuating based on an external factor that you have no control over.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I like the idea for my clients, for their livelihood and their security, to know, hey, I'm going to be able to pace along with inflation. I understand that concept mm-hmm. of, you know, when the market's up, take a little more, market's down, take a little less. But for me, I like steady paychecks.
Yeah.
Most of my clients have been used to that.
Right.
So I'm more aligned along the lines of, hey, let's structure income correctly first,
mm-hmm.
and then have all the other subset plans, investment plan, tax plan, estate plan, kind of marry up to that so that we don't have to fluctuate. Because, as you said a moment ago, it's difficult, you know, and it has tax implications if you let an external force, you know, regulate your income.
You know what I think is interesting? I mean, I think some of the things that you're talking about is the difference between, like, the academic fight among advisors, right? Which is like a very inside baseball game, right? You know, we could sit there and be like, oh, let's talk about the efficient frontier and be, you know, whatever. And thankfully, I'm not in that crowd anymore. By the way, get out and see other people beyond the financial services industry. Very exciting, I must say. Now, but you know, what's interesting is I was trying to describe this to somebody because, you know, I went – so when I made this – the flipped from being an investment advisor and into being in broadcast journalism, I would talk to a lot of my personal finance journalist friends and they would say, well, this is what the academic studies show. And I said, but that won't work in real life because really part of the job that you are doing – is as the advisor is, yes, of course, you know all the academic stuff. And I'm sure, Don, you're, you know, all up to date and you're continuing ed and you're super smart and all that stuff. But you also have to have the wisdom to understand who is my client, right? And that's, I think it's really important for the industry to be sensitive to this idea that, you know what, some people, it may not make the most, it might not be the most prudent financial advice, but you know your clients, right? You know what's going to work. And I'm sure they trust you for that. So it's not going to be, it may be like, oh, this is a really great idea. Like, yes, when the market's up, take out more money, take less money. But don't most people, they just want to, like you said, they want an income stream and they want to know what they've got. So I want to shift gears a tiny bit. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts as we talk about retirement around long-term care planning. Are you a fan of buying long-term care insurance for the right people, or do you think it's a waste of money?
Well, good question, Jill. I'm glad you're asking those super simple questions.
Nice. Lay it up for me, baby.
Long-term care is an interesting subject. And here's kind of my consensus on it. You know, potentially going on vacation might be a waste of money, but
right.
Yet we go.
Right.
Because we want it.
Right.
Long-term care planning kind of goes along that same line. Even if someone is what we could deem as potentially self-insurable, they've got enough assets, even if they sustained a long-term care event mm-hmm. in their lives, that the surviving spouse is still going to be okay.
Right.
So then it comes down to want to. Some people want to plan for it, and some people who actually probably should don't.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the conversation. As long as they know the consequences of their decisions and are comfortable with them, I'm okay with it. Now, personally, you know, I like to make sure that, for me, everything's taken care of. So I will probably gravitate eventually toward long-term care myself when I think that I can optimize, you know, I've got the actuaries over a barrel.
Yeah, you know what he's talking about, guys. So what he's talking about is when it makes sense, you're probably a young guy, but, you know, when you buy your long-term care insurance when you're very young, you're kind of, you're letting the insurance company win a little bit. But if you wait until you're too old, A, you might develop some horrible condition that will preclude you from actually getting that coverage, or your coverage might be really expensive. So, you know, there's some middle ground there. And you know what I think is funny about long-term care? I don't know why, but it makes me laugh out loud when someone says to me, well, what if I don't need it? I don't drive my car all year long and say, oh, darn it, I wish I'd gotten into an accident so I could have used my insurance. Oh, my God. Come on, people. All right. Now, when we come back, we're going to put it to the, we're going to give him some hard questions. Don, we're going to be talking about investing when we get back. So prepare. Get ready during this break. Don Cloud joins us. He is the president and founder of Cloud Financial, and you are listening to Jill on Money. The phone number here, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Young, old, it doesn't matter. She's here to help you. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money. The phone number here is 855-411-JILL or send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. I am Jill Schlesinger. Mark is running the show. And we have a special guest. His name is Don Cloud. And we invited him because he's got a super cool accent. Oh, wait a minute. He's also the president and founder of Cloud Financial. And Don, before we went to the break, are you nervous now? Because you think I'm going to like try to get you with a tough question? Are you worried?
Not at all.
You're so cool.
I'm like ass man.
Nice. First of all, ass. That's a long word. Ass. Okay.
We may add a few syllables.
I love that. I do love it. Believe me. Okay. So you got clients out there, right? And I know you're a believer in a diversified portfolio, right?
Absolutely.
You're the man, right? Okay. And I also know that you probably have clients who are saying to you, gee, I wish I had more of that NASDAQ. That's up so much more than the S&P. Or why do I own this lousy international fund that's down? Talk us off the ledge. Tell us about, just talk about diversification a little bit, because people, they know it's good for them, but you know, oh gosh, it's great for me to eat spinach. I don't want to do it all the time. Sometimes I want ice cream.
Yeah, so a lot of that just comes down to managing expectations. Of course, the S&P's up, international's down. You know, next week it'll be inverted. 3 months ago it was, why are we in domestic when we should be in international?
Right.
You know, it's continually back and forth and back and forth. And I always try to relate it to things that clients understand. It's like if I took a snapshot of a football game in the third quarter and asked you who was winning, and it was just one picture, you might say it's a team with a ball.
Right.
But as we all know, it's not one snapshot. It's the whole game.
Right.
It's the whole thing. And as we talk about diversification is very important. You know, making sure that we've got a portfolio that's designed to do exactly what the client's expectations are.
And you know what's so funny about that? I know that there are times where everybody says, oh, crap, why didn't I just own that thing? And it is you. That's the beauty. I will say that, you know, although I'm not in the business anymore, I'm a huge fan of using financial advisors simply because they can remind you of the basics. You know, you bring up the sports analogy. I always think about that because I'm an aging athlete. And I think, you know, even when I played sports in college, I still had a needed reminder about the basics. You still have to, you know, I was a soccer player. You have to shoot 100 penalty kicks all the time because, you know what? You're going to have to shoot a penalty kick under pressure. Not like the World Cup, but, you know. But, you know, it's those absolute basics are the fundamental part of your whole game plan. And so if your emotions trump that, you're really in trouble. So what do you do if somebody wants to take on strange amounts of risk. Do you just say, okay, go take a fun money account? Like if someone really wants a gambling account, do you just say, go off and do your thing?
Yeah, you know, and it comes back, all right, to having conversations with clients.
Right.
You know, how much of X are you willing to lose? Well, I don't care if I lose all of this $10,000. Okay, well, that could be your gambling account.
Right.
You know, if you want to go bet on biotech, or you want to bet on this, or you want to, you know, that's great. I think that you should do that. If you have that craving, that desire, like I said earlier, you know, maybe going on vacation is not the smartest financial tool, but boy, I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I okay? get that. I get it. I love that.
Same,
I mean, I think that's
scenario.
Smart.
You know, get that fix, get that, you know, and if you do phenomenally, hey, look at how much extra you've got.
Right.
Now, then you've got your financial plan.
Right.
Okay? And then when it comes to your financial plan, man, just like, you know, baseball teams go to spring training and they're throwing and catching and hitting the ball.
Mm-hmm.
The basics, the fundamental. When you stray too far away from fundamentals, bad things happen. So
Right. Own
your retirement, own your plan. You need to pretty much stay on a fundamental type of platform.
And what do you do if somebody's got like a huge slug of company stock in their 401k and they're about to retire? Do you have the fight with them anymore? Or in other words, you saw in the 90s when people were going nuts, right? They had all that money in company stock inside their 401k and they were very reluctant to sell it. Has that shifted now? I mean, have we been Enroned enough so that we don't have to worry about that? Are people more sane about that question?
Well, it depends. Are you talking about an employee that worked there for 35 years?
Yes.
I'm
telling you, the 30, that's exactly what I'm thinking about, as a matter of fact. So I work at CBS, right? And I have people who come to me all the time and they say, and they're lifers at CBS,
yep.
And they won't sell a share of stock. And I think it's insanity. But, you know, I've only worked there for 6 years. So
Correct. What
do you do with them? Do you just scare the you-know-what out of them? I like doing that, believe me.
Well, number one is, you know, especially if they've got a lot of price appreciation, there's always NUA, net unrealized appreciation, you know, when they can move that stock out and play capital gains on it. So sometimes that's enough of an incentive
right.
to get people to do that change. And then the other thing is, you know, a lot of times we do have to have the conversation about one stock. One piece of risk. I remember a client in 07, or not a client, someone who came to me for some advice. She didn't become a client, who said, I am really conservative. And her whole estate, wait for this, was in bank stock.
Oh, Lord, come on.
I'm serious.
No.
And periodically, I still remember that lady. I'm like, man, I didn't do a good enough job. And she said she was conservative to help her understand the importance of diversification.
You can only do so much.
Yep.
Don Cloud, I am so happy that you joined us today. Thank you so much. I'm going to link to Don's website. You could see him. He's got a little video on the website, so you can, if you want more of the accent, which I can't get enough of, you can fly high with Don Cloud on your own time. Don, thank you for joining us here on the Jill on Money show, and you are a terrific guest, so it was great. If you've got a financial question, we would love to hear from you. Two ways to get in touch with us, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We will be right back.
Young, old, it doesn't matter. She's here to help you. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
Friday night, I crashed your
car. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. 855-411-JILL. Or send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. And if you missed any of our interview with Don Cloud, financial advisor, Don Cloud. You can go onto the website, JillOnMoney.com, and listen to whatever you missed. So easy. Just go on over there. All right. That's an interesting question, and one that I'm really intrigued with, because I think more and more we are going to hear about people working through retirement. In other words, you'll retire from your real job, but then you'll do something else. You're going to work during retirement doing something. It's not going to necessarily be the same grind, because that's kind of a rough go, right? You're not, but you might need some money. You know, it's interesting. I saw a survey from Transamerica, and they said 82% of workers in their 60s or older said they expect to or are working past 65. Now, I mean, look, obviously a lot of those people are doing it for the money, but others just are doing it because they like working and they want to stay active and involved. And that survey found that, you know, something like less than 15% just walk out the door at a certain age. And even fewer leave about half that. 7% said they would be done just when they hit a specific saving goal. So what's happening is people really do want to work longer, and they want to figure out a way to be active. They're healthy. They're great. But they don't want to necessarily wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and work a 12-hour day and come home and commute and all those things. So why am I telling you this? Because I think working in retirement is really going to be a fact of life for a lot of people. And here's our question from Chet, who is fully retired, and he is taking his required minimum distribution. Remember, he turned 70 and a half. The government says you've got to pull money out of your retirement account because that money has not yet been taxed. And to make sure that the government gets to tax it, they want you to they require you to take a certain amount every single year. In Chet's case, he's fully retired, but his wife works part-time. So she's got earned income. And he says, my question is, can I contribute to my Roth IRA while taking required minimum distributions from my traditional IRA? Interesting question. Here is your answer. You cannot contribute to a Roth IRA because you don't have earned income. Your wife does. However, your wife can contribute to a Roth IRA after the age of 70 and a half, as long as she has compensation and meets the income eligibility requirements. Okay? So, you know, just because you filed jointly, minimum required distribution, okay, that is something that is based on your Social Security number. You see, it's your MRD or RMD, whichever you like to call it. And there's no way, in other words, you can't take your required distribution out of your wife's IRA. It has to come from your IRA that's in your Social Security number. Now, I just want to also say there is a really interesting little twist here. And in some circumstances, you can delay those required distributions from a retirement plan from a current employer, like a 401k or a 403b, until after you retire. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And, of course, a Roth is not subject to a distribution, right? Because the money's been taxed already. So the answer to your question, Chet, is that maybe your wife can actually contribute to a Roth, but you don't have earned income. With earned income is the key. And it's earned income. Whoever's getting that in earned income can make some contribution. But if you are fully retired, you don't have any earned income, you've got passive income, you're taking money, you know, if there's, and you'll know the difference between passive and earned income because of the way the tax reporting goes. You cannot make a contribution without earned income. Good try, though. I give him a lot for the try, but no. I just wanted one other thing, by the way, just about working in retirement, because I always like to, I ran across a couple of really two great resources for people who are looking to work beyond in their 60s, say. There's a website called seniorjobbank.org, and it's got, you know, search capabilities. I don't know if you're interested or not, but there's this other, I love this website that I found called hourlynerd.com, hourlynerd.com. this is a cool thing, because if you have an MBA or very specific industry experience, this site connects consultants to companies that need help, and they do it by using technology. And what's really very interesting about the site is that it was formed by a couple of guys who were at Harvard Business School, and it was, I think, their senior thesis or a project they had done, and everybody poo-pooed the idea. And meanwhile, they went and launched it on their own, and it's a thriving website. So I encourage you to check out hourlynerd.com, especially if you're thinking about going off and actually doing a little something in your retirement spare time. And one other quick question about the required minimum distribution. Remember, the firms that you're doing business with should be letting you know when you have to take your distribution. But once you turn age 70, put yourself on red alert, put some sort of calendar reminder in, and get busy. Make sure you take those distributions, because don't forget, the penalty is very steep. You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL, or send an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. Phone number here is 855-411-JILL. And you can always reach us by email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. It's fabulous. Finishing up, because we've gotten a bunch of questions about buying versus renting, and just to clarify a couple of things. If you want maximum flexibility, renting is fine. But you just have to understand that you're going to face some pressure, because rents are rising. They're rising very quickly in some areas. So I don't want anyone to hear like one is better than the other. It really has to do with your specific situation. Okay, good. Now I've put that aside. I got a question about whether someone should buy life insurance for their infant. Oh, I hate that idea. Oh my God. Amy writes, I just had a baby. My parents are asking whether they can buy a whole life policy for her. What do you think? I think they might as well just burn their money up. I think it's about the worst. Not the worst. It's not a smart idea, because your kid doesn't need life insurance. You buy life insurance because in the event of a death, that there is some financial need. And I mean, it would be horrible if your baby died or your child died. It would be awful. The worst thing in the world. Unimaginable. But there's not going to be a consequence of somebody suffering financially as a result of that death. And I don't love using insurance just because, you know, that what many insurance agents will say is you're insuring his or her insurability. I think that's nonsense. So no, you know what you can do? You can tell your parents that whatever money they were going to put into that whole life insurance policy, that they can instead put it into a 529 plan for your kid's college education. That is useful. That is a smart way to start planning for the future. No insurance for babies, please. Let's avoid that at all costs. All right, it's been a great show. Thank you so much for listening. The phone number here all week long, 855-411-JILL, and you can always send us an email day or night, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Thanks to Don Cloud for joining us, and thanks to you for listening, and we'll see you on the radio next weekend.